Well, I wanted you to know I had a blast this morning talking with you guys. When Ralph asked me if I would come and be with you last year after I was with the East Coast Connection, he asked me if I'd come here. And I said yes, and then I realized that in order to do what I thought God wanted me to do, I needed to kind of look at my own life and survey where my own growing edges were. And talk about that rather than, you know, rerun something. So, you know, I used to speak to thousands of people all the time. I used to speak all the time. And now I don't. Like many of you, the nature of my ministry has changed when I came out. And so it was a treat for me to have the occasion to look at my life and my growing edges and my growing convictions and then create a message out of it, and to have you all gracious enough to sit and listen to me. So first thing I wanted to say was thank you for being so gracious and joining with me in that hour of our wild and precious lives. Yeah. So I'm interested to hear, you know, what stuck with you this morning that you want to talk some more about. Maybe I'll get a chair so I can sit up and see all of your faces.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I can tell you, excuse me.
Why don't you start?
I can tell you in very briefly what impacted me. Over the last few weeks, I thought I'd lost my entire life, my children, my marriage, my reputation, my finances, my companies. Everything was gone.
Everybody here, Dan?
I said over the last few weeks, over the last 2 years, my career, my marriage, my communication with my children, my sexual identity, everything in my life was wiped out. And it's only been the last couple of months that I came to realize that I hadn't lost everything. I had been freed from all of the chains that were destroying me. And this morning, in your message, you talked about finding that sunlight in the dark places by going through it. And where you went connected exactly to where I had been and reaffirmed in my own life what God had been doing to me. Yeah. I absolutely understood.
Yeah,
then we can pass one
around.
Is this one on?
So that connected.
Yeah.
That theme connected.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Scott?
Two things that I wanted to say. One of them I've already said to you, but I'll just say it in front of the whole group then, too. And that is that I realized that not only am I needing to come to grips with the fact that I don't have to be the victim and the other person doesn't have to be the bad guy, that it's also true the other way around, that I don't have to be the bad guy and the other person doesn't need to be the victim either. And well, I guess let me give you a context for that. I'm married and I'm really struggling with issues in relationship to my wife, and she's of course struggling with issues in relationship to me.
Yeah.
And it's really true in both directions for us, I think. The other thing that that really struck me in your presentation was that when you described Yeshua for me, I have had what I call a safe place that's been very important for me, and it's a place that I run to a lot. More so recently.
Tim, could you pass that back?
Oh, is it on?
Yeah.
Testing.
Okay.
It's a place that Yeshua has been a safe place for me. It's a place that I run to a lot, and it looks a heck of a lot like what you described as isolation in Auschwitz. And to hear it defined as an open space, I may not be able to say this without crying, to hear this described as an open place with sunshine and fresh air is the most amazing thought, so amazing that I almost didn't think I could listen to what you said when you said it. I just had to hang on to your dear life as you talked, because it so contradicts what has been safety for me for years at this point. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to say that I've experienced that whiteness that we talked about. For a very long time, I was like Jeremiah hiding in the cave. Or was it Jeremiah?
Elijah.
Yeah, I was like Elijah hiding in the cave, afraid of what would happen. In 2001, the beginning of the year, I had decided to accept my Christianity and my homosexuality together. I'd been fighting against it all my life. I'd already been out. Everybody knew that I was struggling, but it was an issue for me to be able to accept that this is who I am.
Yeah.
And that was a big step for me to accept that. And I told my friends, and I got a lot of criticism saying, well, you can't do this. And I kind of cowered back again. And in just the last few months, I've been feeling really confident again, trusting in God's grace to take care of me as I've come out more and more. I've come out to my church. People in my church are very aware of who I am, and I've actually met some other gay men in my church. I was very surprised.
Yeah.
Then last week I came out through the local newspaper because they did an article on our Bible study group, and I shared a lot of my own life. They didn't quote me very much, but they did have my picture in the paper, and I just thought it was a powerful way to kind of get my story out. And, you know, the reporter asked, well, if anybody does not want to be in the story, let us know. And I was like, I'm not afraid. I'm just going to say what I need to say and let God take care of the rest.
Okay. Thank you. Pass it back.
I just wanted to say, and I shared this in our family group, I thought your presentation and it's not a non-spiritual thing, but I really watch how someone presents when they're speaking, and yours was a complete package. You opened it up and then tied it all together with a pretty bow. It was a funny presentation. But I wanted to let you know, and I shared this with a small group. February 2002, I attended Franklin Graham's International Christian Conference on HIV and AIDS, and there were 1,000 people, 81 countries represented. I was in the Washington Hilton. I got picked up in the airport with a black limousine, all the glitz, all the glamour, and I listened, and I said, sat there, listened, and I thought, Lord, this conference has more substance, more solid style, and is more spiritual than that we spent with Franklin Graham and the conservatives. And I think this conference and your message, the type of message you delivered, have a far greater reaching impact than the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars they spent in Washington, D.C. And that will be on the evaluation form. I'm going to write that. But one of the nicest things about your presentation was you spoke words that each one of us speak every day.
Yes.
And I appreciate it. And I know from the feedback I'm talking to others, you really minister to us.
Thank you. So I've got some questions for you all. Does anybody have little ancient alarm bells go off when they talked about how about the spaciousness of God's reconciliation? You know, that as I mentioned, that passage we've all heard sermons on about the way being narrow. You know, Matthew 7.
Yeah. Yeah,
did anybody get a little bit nervous when I said that that there's a spaciousness to true reconciliation?
Mm-mm.
That make you nervous? Yeah? You're nodding, Scott.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah, that's a really frightening idea to me. That was part of what I meant by my, my being closed in. I mean, the only safe place in the world is dark and tiny. Mm-hmm. It is the only safe place in the world. And to think about it differently is a real challenge. To think about acceptance as a place of safety. It's hard to get to.
Yeah.
It's just hard to get to.
May I share something real quick?
Of course. Thank you.
What he's talking about, I urge anyone that is coming to a place, if you want a theme song for your life, Sandy Patty has a song called You Set Me Free. And I made that the theme song for 1999 for my life. I decided to keep it. But basically, she talks about how we can walk away and sets us free from all the things in the past. And to soar, to fly. Have you heard that song?
No.
But if you want a song to listen to over and over again to feed your spirit, to be able to go into the spaciousness of reconciliation and move on, that's a great song.
Yeah, I'm back there. My name is Maggie. I came in a little late, but I agree with the way you spoke. Let me stand up, that way you can hear.
All right, I think this is a longer cord.
I'm not used to speaking with them. I'm going to go public speaker. Well, I'm like you. Tears are in my throat. It's kind of hard to prepare. This morning, you spoke so many things that were, I think, it's already been spoken, speaking from out of the depths of some of our own hearts and struggles, and there was one thing you said, and there were many things, but it was one thing that kind of rang, and I don't agree about wording your talk, but I just had one question. You talked about knowing how to fall. Mm-hmm. And I would like you to expound on that, because I have fallen. I am falling. I have fell. Let's go through the tenses, you know. I am, I have, I will be, I will again, probably. But
yes.
How can I cause the least amount of injury? Because it is very painful right now, whatever process is happening in this. And spaciousness, if that applies to that.
I would be happy. Can I add a footnote to that?
Yeah.
If we're still on the way down and we haven't hit yet, we don't know if the parachute's going to open or not.
Yeah. Of course.
Add that to the tenth. Yeah. Down.
I will have fallen.
Yes. I am falling.
Yeah.
I'm reading English.
Well, I immediately resonated with that author's metaphor. Because you know, most of us, when we played sports when we were kids, or even more recently, somebody taught us to fall. You know, if nothing more than just sort of tuck your head. You know, if you're gonna go down this way.
Okay, how do we emotionally fall?
And I'm thinking about a session I did with a wonderful couple the other day. One of them had an affair. Okay, so the fall had happened, and this couple was really struggling to know if they could go on. And so they were learning to fall. They were learning to land, I guess. I'm still thinking about the metaphor, but it was very clear that they could do further damage to their relationship by failing. And I just thought in the towel. They knew that they had a covenant relationship. One of them had an affair. Both of them knew about it. And they know that they could either tuck their hips, so to speak, and land and start the recovery, or they could fail. They could just say, screw it. You know, we're not going to go forward together, which would have done further damage to both of them and obviously their covenant. So that's the first example that comes to my mind.
What if you're not just falling off your feet? What if you just got shoved out on an airplane and you're heading straight for the ground? And you don't know if you've got a parachute on or not?
Well, then I think you have to go back to God's nature. Will you die?
Well, that's the question.
Will you die? And there are some questions to which you don't know the answer, and you must say, well, I am living in chaos. I believe God wants me to live until I land. But if there's a way, I can continue to live and honor him, then I want to. Yesterday I marked the anniversary of the Big Thompson flood. It was 20-some years ago. Some of you remember the story. There were 20 of us at Campus Crusader up in the Big Thompson River in Colorado, and a flash flood came through. And seven of my friends were killed that night. That evening, it hit about 9 o'clock, and we've been given about 5 minutes to get out of the lodging we were in and get to high ground. So I literally got to a crossroads with my car, and I remember seeing a figure that pointed up the hill, that I should go up the hill. Nobody else saw that figure in the bright yellow raincoat that night. So I headed up the hill, and four of the cars behind me didn't follow me. They went across the bridge, and two of those four cars went into the river. And I remember standing on that bluff looking down on the Big Thompson River as an 18-foot wall of water came crashing down that canyon, took the bridge out. And I saw on the crest of that wave cars and trucks with their lights still on. And my friends and I stood in the rain on that cliff looking into the Big Thompson Canyon. There is as it empties out and heads down towards Loveland. And boy, we wondered if God made a mistake. I learned later that two of the women in the two cars survived, and were able to tell us what went on in the cars. And those women learned to fall. They had walked with God in life, and almost effortlessly they stepped into heaven. There was no freaking out in the back seat. They were in those cars that, you know, where you can't get out, basically. The windows don't roll down, it's a two-door car. They were stuck and they knew it. They weren't freaking out. They were cursing God. They weren't trampling each other. They were in prayer. And they died in prayer. So there are times in our life where, you're right, the parachute is not going to open and we're going to step into heaven, literally. And all I knew from reflecting on those young lives of my friends, we were all in our 20s, was that they had just walked steadily, faithfully with God here. And when they fell, they tucked. And they woke up in paradise. So I don't want to minimize this, you know, learning to fall stuff. Sometimes we fall into heaven, I know we do. Sometimes it's not our time yet. And we, like I think I look at my own life in 1993, I knew that my relationship was over, I knew that my career with Campus Crusade was over, I knew there were more question marks than I knew how to do it. And I had that feeling that I could land with a splat. I could absolutely land with this flat and it'll be over. Or maybe I wouldn't. And it's not my, it's not to my credit that I did, other than I have learned to walk with God a little bit.
In that respect, wouldn't God be your parachute? He's either going to be your parachute or he's going to take your hand and take you home.
That's right. And I remember Peter. And I said his goal, you know, when I talked to him, he said his goal was to help build a soft spot to land. You know, that he couldn't reduce the force of gravity. God didn't operate that way, but he could create a softer spot to land. And God did.
Falling in faithfulness is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Falling in faithfulness. Yeah.
You talk about falling, and it reminds me of the summer of, I think it was, I can't remember if it was 91 or 92, I was in college. I was doing a summer internship with a ministry based in Texas. I and a ministry partner were traveling around the Southeast, going to various Christian camps, I was a journalism intern. He was a photography intern. And our goal was to update a lot of the camp literature. I had become infatuated with him and with one of the counselors at one of the camps where we were. One afternoon or morning or whatever it was, I was laying on the beach and this camp counselor was laying next to me with his girlfriend, and I reached over and started massaging his back, and he didn't care for that at all, but he didn't stop me. And somewhere down the line, something happened. I can't say exactly what, but I just got so depressed. And my partner was from Alaska, and he's, despite the rules that we weren't supposed to be carrying any weapons or anything, he told me that he had a gun in his suitcase. And I wrote him a note. We were in the gymnasium together, and I wrote him a note and said, "Hide your gun." I didn't want to kill myself, but I was afraid I might. He said he ran out of there and grabbed it and made sure that everything was okay. Eventually word got back to my ministry, and I was brought back to Texas to undergo counseling and whatnot. I remember I was in, I think I was in Virginia at the time, and they put me on a bus from Virginia to Texas. And I remember sitting on that bus. I had a steno notebook like this. I think I filled 20 pages in 2 days on that bus ride. I'm just crying out to God. I'm scared, I'm scared, I'm scared. I'm falling, but I haven't hit bottom. What I felt like was a tennis ball bouncing along the walls, never knowing when I'm going to hit bottom. Is this bottom or is this a wall? Is this bottom or is this a wall? And I don't know if I ever did hit bottom. I'm still wrestling with a lot of those same issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I feel like that tennis ball is bouncing back and forth. When do I come to a rest? When can I just hit that bottom and be done? And that's a hard question.
Yeah. How do you know when it's bottom?
That's a good question. I don't.
When do you know? How do you know if it's bottom? Do you have an answer for that?
Oh, what a good question. How do you know if it's the bottom?
Yeah, because that's a good point, because we've all been bounced around. And wondering, is
this... I knew for me it was the bottom when I was literally, I remember being prostrate before the Lord in my living room. Yeah. I tried to kneel, and I couldn't kneel anymore. I just had to kind of lay down, face down, no carpet. And I said, "Oh, Lord, I don't know what to do anymore."
I think for me, there was nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
It was all gone. Everything.
And for me, I lost the person that I was in a relationship with. I lost my ministry. I had not lost my health. I lost, for a while, my family member who was in addiction. I lost my dog. I lost a lot of things. But I had to be, I was reminded in the way Elijah was. God said, you got stuff. You got stuff. You got a few people that love you. Remember the first person you voluntarily came out to? Mm-hmm. Mine was a person named Barbara, straight woman, who just is kind and sweet. I go around telling straight people, if a gay person ever comes out to them, that they should be hugely honored, because it means that they have been compassionate, trustworthy, and safe. So I had Barbara. I had my health. I was able to pay my bills. So God had to remind me of those things. Hmm. My molecules were still holding together. Didn't fly apart in space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gratitude. Being aware enough to be grateful meant the world to me. you're a naturally optimistic person, it really helps in these times. And if you're not, it's great to pull someone around you who's sort of a little bit of an optimist.
I force myself to be optimistic. It doesn't come naturally.
Yeah, it can be a discipline. Yeah, Shana, can you tell us?
I was just kind of scratching my head.
I was kind of scratching my head that I guess I did have something maybe kind of changing the subject a little bit, but I really enjoyed your talk this morning too. It was great. I never knew you were so great, even when I knew you in Seattle. You were great then. Now you're even better. But I know in my life I'm really big into reconciliation, especially with other people, because you know sometimes we have conflicts in the body of Christ, and I feel like I'm really big into seeking to reconcile with people. But sometimes they absolutely refuse. They're like, well, no, I don't believe that we're called to be reconciled to one another.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I've had people say that. I don't know. I think you kind of touched on, maybe you touched on it, like letting people be themselves, agree, disagree, or something. But I guess I just, you know, I really have a problem with, you know, when there are issues in the body of Christ and people are like refusing to deal with the issues. And I don't know, in terms of reconciliation, what would you say about that?
You mean reconciliation with other Christians that have been judgmental of you?
Yeah, just reconciliation with other Christians that, you know, that I think it grieves God to see disharmony in the body of Christ. And, you know, is there any easy way to do that?
Well, I'll speak from my life, and then maybe others here will speak from theirs. I know there are people that have that don't want to know me anymore, and that doesn't mean they're bad or I'm bad. They just don't have the grace for that, or maybe I don't. I wish them well. Hopefully, they wish me well. And then there are others like my brother Ron I told you about this morning, where we know we belong to each other, and I believe God's working in his life, and he believes God's working in my life, and it's just taken a lot of time, and it will take more and more time. I don't feel compelled to go hat in hand to everybody and get their approval and get them to be okay with me.
Patricia?
Yeah.
What if they were your two grown sons who wouldn't talk with you and hadn't been over a year and a half because you're now a gay man and you're divorcing your mother?
Did everybody hear that? Would you repeat that?
I said, what if... What would you say if they were your two grown sons who broke off all communication with you over a year and a half ago because you just told them that you're a gay man and you're divorcing your mother?
I don't have children. I can't imagine the heartbreak of that. I do believe in the reality that fathers have gifts for their children. Always. It's never too late to have gifts for your children, whether or not you're in a relationship with them, but that's how the law of love works. But the gifts go from you to them. That their obligation is not to give you gifts, not to make you happy. The obligation is from you to them, to bless them, to love them.
Mm-hmm.
They have intentions of good towards them. If they turn around, it's wonderful. If they don't, you're doing your job as a father. And I know it hurts like fire to not have them turn around and honor you as they should. But that's my sense of it. If you still have gifts for them, God will give you the creativity to know how to continue to give to them. I do believe that's how God works. You have gifts for them.
Well, that's been my affirmation, because that's what the Lord has been impressing on my heart. Just love them unconditionally and ask nothing in return.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do.
It is not easy. You need support around you to keep your tanks full for that to happen. Yeah.
Don't we have four people falling at this point with him?
Yeah, that's a good point. There are four people learning to fall.
Yeah.
You, your wife, and two kids. Well, there's five. Me, my wife, and three children, but my youngest son is gay, and so he's happy to have a gay dad. But he's very unhappy that his father's divorcing his mother. It's a double-edged sword.
Mm. Yeah. You think you're a bad guy?
No, but I think because I never dealt with my sexuality years ago like I should have, and never did anything to get healthy as a gay man, I left a trail of broken relationships trying to be something I wasn't. My gayness destroyed my lack of dealing with who I am and accepting my gayness is what destroyed my family. Trying to get healthy, I think, is the only thing that will save me.
I'm noticing that we have a number of fathers, maybe some mothers in the room.
Yeah, I think one of the real challenges for me has been to try to figure out how to stay in relationship with my son and figure out how to take appropriate steps, and maybe in terms of, I don't know if this is useful for anybody, and I may not even be, you probably need to comment on this, the appropriateness of it. But, I mean, one of the things I've tried to do is to slow everything down so that I was more deliberate, because I couldn't even tell what was, I didn't know which direction was up, basically. And I probably still do not, although I'm more sensitive now than I did for a long time. But in terms specifically of my son, he was 17, 18, entering his senior year in high school when I told him about my sexual orientation. And he was very angry and has been very angry at me for a long time. He has yelled at me in public situations. He's challenged me pretty hard in street corners. And, I mean, there have been some really difficult times. And the thing that I've worked really, really hard to do is to let him know that I care deeply for him. And for a long time, that was the best I could do. And he still has not responded to the letter I wrote when he was 21. But I've never responded to the letter my parents wrote me when I was 21 either. So I tend to remember that maybe I don't deserve an answer. So that's one thought I have. But the other thing is that as he's gotten older, it's been several years now, as he's gotten older, we've gotten to a place where he allows me into parts of his life. And I just say thank you and try to listen and try to respond. And if there's ever more I really am a mess right now. Anyway, if there's more, I'll just praise God for it, because it's what God gives me back. And my son, if he does, you know, to the extent that he's willing to come back into a relationship.
Yeah.
I'd like to share about an experience.
Hang on just a second, I want to respond. I think there's a lot to what you're saying about being non-reactive. You know, automatically, if you think about any situation you're in, the person that is the least anxious is automatically the most powerful, most influential. Think about that, whether it's a political debate or somebody that's upset with you from your family or from your church or your employment. The person that's most able to just breathe and do what you just did, Scott. You know, you're speaking to us, you know, the emotion came up and you just closed your eyes, hung on to the microphone. You didn't say, oh, go this way. You just kept breathing and then you finished your thought. That you stayed and you calmed yourself. You noticed your anxiety, you breathed into it, and you calmed yourself. That's a great example, I think, of what I was talking about this morning, about how God cares about our messages from our bodies. Because if you're not listening to your body, oftentimes, all you have as a recourse is to be reactive. You know, to throw your ball. You know, the kid says, damn you, Dad! All you can say is, I'm your father, you can't speak to me that way. You know, and then it escalates from there, right? Right? So our job is to, in the spirit of Jesus Christ, be the non-anxious presence in these exchanges. And that takes the kind of discipline of awareness that I was talking about this morning when you just did it. Tim, we left you behind a minute ago. Do you have something?
I wanted to share a little bit about my relationship with my dad. My dad was very phobic, very discriminatory in a lot of ways. He criticized my brother when he was dating a black girl. He criticized me for being gay. There was a whole lot of issues that my dad was a very bitter, angry person. And I, in the summer of 83, I had seen how one brother had reacted and had become just as bitter and just as angry and spiteful and hateful. And he came close to beating my dad, literally. And I was a Christian then, and God just really touched my heart with sorrow about the relationship between them. And he showed me about the relationship with me and my dad, and how I had become angry and bitter toward him. And God told me that I needed to forgive my dad. And it was hard at first. I don't think I had anything specifically against him at that point. I just had a general attitude of dislike. But for the next 10.5 years, my prayer was, God, bring him back to you. He knew you once. Bring him back. And the second part of that prayer was, don't let him die until he is right with you. And I shared my faith with him. I shared the gospel with him time and again. We had a tradition, the church where he grew up, every Palm Sunday they had a men's breakfast. And he'd like to go, and as I got older, I got interested in that, so we'd go together. And he would share some things that I knew that he knew Christ. I didn't think he was following him, but I knew that he knew Christ. Halloween night of 93, my senior year of college, I called just to see how he was doing. And the reason I called was because he was approaching his 71st birthday in a couple weeks. And I had missed his 70th birthday. I wanted to have a big shebang for number 70. And I felt bad that I didn't. So I called him that night, just let him know I'm thinking about him. And he went off on a tangent about something that his sister did like 40 or 50 years ago that he was still bitter about. He had not forgiven his sister. And I told him about forgiveness.
He says, I can't. And I talked to him about how Christ forgives. He says, oh, that's because he's God. I said, yeah, but you have the power in you through Christ. And I said, I've forgiven you because of Christ that lives in me. And you can forgive your sister because of Christ in you. And a week and a half later, I got a call that he was dead. My last conversation with him was about forgiveness. And I don't know what happened in those next few days. He was very silent. He never responded to my talk about forgiveness. And I don't know how he reacted in the next few days after I hung up. I don't know if God spoke to his heart, if God touched him. I may never know. I know shortly after the funeral, I had a dream of rescuing him from a fire, as if God told me that I really did something for my dad.
Thank you.
I have a question about something that you mentioned today. Mm-hmm. I relate what you said about just really staying attentive all the time, and how the journey is not about different techniques and stuff that you do in your spare time, but just about remaining attentive. And I was just wondering, you know, there's really a temptation to either tune out or get involved in some sort of addiction. And in, you know, I've known in my life it may not be something like tangible, like drugs or alcohol, but it may be busy schedule, maybe a fear. I was wondering if you had any insight as to how you can stay attentive.
Good question. How to stay attentive. I know some of y'all grew up, you know, with the discipline of a devotional time. Raise your hand if you did that. You know, at some point in your life, you grew up with a real sense of, you know, mornings with God, something like that. I've noticed this is very tied to temperament. Some people like to have times to attend to their heart with somebody else. You extroverts, you know, have a very extrovert friend who says, basically, I bathe alone, otherwise I like to be with people. And you introverts just go, oh, no. My partner is an introvert. And it's been a challenge for us sometimes. We're an extrovert. Sort of follow her around the house. And there are times that she just needs time by herself to meditate. No, that's true for me too. I think it's just a matter of, I have this little formula in my head that I need to take a morning, an afternoon, and an evening, about every 2 or 3 days to just sort of hang out with myself. And it doesn't mean I have to be idle or, you know, in a strictly meditative mode. It seems like I kind of have to be alone with my thoughts. My latest thing is watering the garden. It's been hot in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So I have just had a blast this summer. Just whipped the hose out there, you know, watering the garden, letting my mind go, listening to God, listening to me. I do this little check-in where I check in about, I think of it as an awareness wheel. It's on my website. You can go there and find it. Or if you think about a pizza pie, it's not original with me, although I have added a couple of pie pieces. I take a few minutes and I think about, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What do I want? What's my body doing? What are my true moral obligations versus my bogus moral obligations? And I just sort of check in with myself around those things. But mostly it's just a matter of making sure that I don't overschedule myself. I make time for myself. And that can sound a little narcissistic in this culture. You know, you're supposed to serve to within an inch of your life, right? So there are literally times where, you know, I'll write myself into my calendar. You know, somebody or some client wants me to do something and I'll say, I've got something.
May I ask you, I think there's probably a lot of, I'm probably loud enough. I think there's probably a number of people in this room that are in this situation. I've been very fortunate to grow up in a conservative Christian home, but love was preeminent, so I have been blessed. But I'm at a place now, and I bet a lot of you are, where you have older folks that are absolutely established in the fundamentalist view about homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And I'm at a place in my family where I don't necessarily feel the need to disrupt their lives at this stage of their lives.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Because I just don't want to enter into disrupting family that I love that are nearing the end of the line. What are your thoughts?
Everybody hear that? Thoughts about feeling like you're disrupting some older family members. There's a wonderful book out in the last year or so by Mary Pfeiffer called Another Country, Navigating the Spiritual Terrain of Our Elders. And in reading that, she's confirmed a few hunches of mine that our elders are maybe far more resilient than we gave them credit for. They've survived a ton of stuff. I remember talking with a woman who was about 105 years old when I met her, a former missionary. Somebody said, well, you're a missionary, you should go talk to her. So I went over and talked to her. And she had survived two or three husbands, you know, a couple decades in India, and even some of her own children. And now she was in a nursing home in a pretty infirm condition. And I said, her name was Mrs. Armstrong. I said, Mrs. Armstrong, I was maybe 22 or 3 at the time, so I was trying to think of a really profound question. The one I came up with was, why do you think God allowed you to live so long? And she just smiled back at me like, you goofball. I couldn't offend her. And she just gave me the sweetest answer. She said, did you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the end of the world, does not grow weary or tired. He gives strength to the weary, does not grow weary or tired. He gives strength to the weary, and to those who lack strength, he increases power.
Isaiah 40.
Though vigorous young women grow weary, and youth stumble and faint, those who wait on the Lord will gain his strength. They will run and not grow weary. She sat up real tall in a wheelchair. They will walk and not faint. That was her answer. And I saw in her far more resilience than, frankly, I saw in me at that stage of the game. So, I've had enough other older folks in my life to see that they're a little tougher than I think. With my own parents, who've sort of come to a place where they don't need to hear the intricacies of my sex life, oddly enough. They don't need to hear that. They love my partner. They welcome her. And I'm sure my dad tells his golfing buddies that this is her roommate. I'm sure that's what he tells them. I don't care. They respect her. They love her. I don't care. I don't need him to be absolutely correct. And I don't need him to do that. And he doesn't need me to stop living my life with him. Mm-hmm.
My health has been kind of not so good, so lately I'm not so sure if I'm, you know, catching things right on. You know, it's just a temporary thing. But I've been thinking about reconciliation, you know, and what I heard, what I received, and what I'm hearing. And that wide open space, you're safe and secure, that peace, that rest, that's Christ, you know. All is well, you know, with Christ. And we're talking about falling, and you just said, how do you know when you hit the bottom? And I know what you mean by, well, you know, it's gonna, you know, it felt like a splat maybe, or whatever, you know. There's no answer to that, because this it's not a doctrine, it's an experience. And it's experience of us personally with God through a time or an event. I don't understand God for what's happened in my life for the past 6 years, but especially the last three. The only way I can describe it is, you know the old slippery slope? I found out what was at the end of that slippery slope. And you just keep going. There's more. And then you think, well, you know, there's got to be an end. You know, I still have some rope. Then I found out what's at the end of the rope. You just keep going. And I dare not say what next. I don't even want to think it, you know, because it just kept going. And I know to some people, they might look at me and my situation and say, boy, what did she do? Or boy, you know, what a loser. Or boy, what this? Or boy, what that? That doesn't feel so good. And there's nothing that I can do about it. And that's what touched me about the visual I got with, you know, in our life, we want to get the answer and fix it, hurry up and fix it. You know, microwave nowadays, you go through Jack in the Box, and if it isn't hot and ready when you get to the window, you know, golly, they're taking a long time. But God doesn't do that. This is not a microwave experience, and it just goes. It's gotten to, you know, you have needs, and you pray, and you pray, and you pray, and you pray, and some he meets, and some he doesn't, because, I don't know, maybe you asked him. I don't know. The only prayer that I have left is, because my Father knows my needs, the only thing I can say anymore is, Lord, you know my need. That's all I can ask. And he's provided. You know, I'm sitting here. He's provided. And our relationships in the family, he'll provide that answer. Christ is at the end, you know, that reconciliation. And our situations and relationships, my gosh, when every muscle and nerve is tied up in that, you know? Eventually, Christ is the answer. But you don't learn. I find that you can be really clever and smart and understand lots of theology and lots of passages and have this and that. But some experiences, there ain't no theology, you know. And to get to that place, you know, the wide open place where there's peace and rest, you know what? It's Christ that goes there. And you know what? And I'll shut up. Is that I once had an experience that went on 5 years that was really tough and really hard. And at the end of the 5 years, I realized it was like I turned around in my experience and I saw that Christ was with me every step of the way, and I never realized it. And it was a hard situation, but I was sorry it was over, because Christ was with me every step of the way. So, it's just Christ.
Thank you, Lord. You know, this morning when I was talking about being wild, free,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Lost,
yes.
It seems to me that over the coming decade or so, one of the things that's going to build respect for us in this culture will be the quality of our relationships, both our partner relationships, our romantic relationships, as well as our friendships and our alliances with each other. You know, there are times where I look at the behavior of gay and lesbian people and I think, though I understand some of that adolescent behavior that we're sometimes guilty of, I know that it just, it proves the point of people that would rather not see us advance and replace in this culture. So I'd be curious to know how you are thinking about wild grief, loss, what I was saying this morning about the gamble, the risk of being a free man or a free woman, and what that means to through your true moral obligations to live as an ethical individual in this culture. Does that make sense? It's a range question, but can you gamble being free and righteous at the same time? Let's hear from somebody on this side of the room. On camera, I saw some heads down. Can you gamble being free and spacious and righteous all at the same time? Yeah.
Well, I thought about this morning when you brought it up. And,
we should have one for each side.
I was thinking about that this morning when you were sharing several things that you brought up, and something that keeps resounding with me, because coming out, one of the reasons I stayed closet, I think, for so long is I didn't know there was such a thing as Christian GLBT people. And my own experience with the culture has been more of that adolescent acting out, substance abusing, promiscuous kind of life, which may happen in our circles too. I'm still learning because I'm really coming out. But I'm on this ongoing process and exploring this new life, and where God is in the midst of it, looking at ways that I get stuck developmentally in my life process and what has contributed to that. And I think being repressed for many years, up until about 3 years ago, has kept me stuck at developmental ages that, as far as the freedom,
sure,
I don't sense the kind of freedom that I see in some people that I might look to as models or mentors who have been down this road quite a few years longer than I have, as far as the integration and the self-expression of that. But I'm becoming more aware that the more I see in me areas I haven't yet touched that need the healing from the years of repression or abuse or whatever family board and stuff we have. I know for me it's alcoholism in my family, a lot of abusive kind of stuff. But I think the freedom for me comes as I continue to do my personal work in the therapy way, is being able to, like what you were asking earlier about your topic, I was very intrigued with that as well, as far as being aware or present, or I forget the word you used. About that attentive
awareness.
You talked about being still, and I think what I'm learning is I'm not very good at that. So I don't medicate with alcohol and drugs like family members of mine have, but I sure can be a workaholic or a task-oriented person, or it used to be in my Christian life, you know, evangelizing people and pouring my life into ministry and witnessing and all that kind of thing as a cover-up for the losses and the loneliness, but still under the guise of my belief that I'm serving my life of the Lord and that's the Lord's thing. And as I've kind of backed away from those roles, I do sense when I walk towards the unresolvedness of things, the freedom is increasing. And it seems what little experience I'm having in that is the more I experience the freedom around facing the truth and letting the layers of roles come off, or the layers of woundedness or whatever it is, strategically that I put in place to create safety and security for myself, there is more of a wildness of, one, not having all the answers and realizing other people don't either, and not looking for other people to give me answers, and that God's bigger than the box that I've been putting him in, or that I've been taught, trained through the ministries that you guys have probably been a part of by first, and that there is a wildness about the whole concept of a creator that I am just getting to know at a level that I think deep down I really hope was there, but I just wouldn't dare even go past the limits of the box. And I think as well as when I've learned that there's healing from the woundedness, I've developed and only grown through some of that childlike stuff,
and that's the kind of stuff, and there is a level and layer of integrity and connectedness through all the painful process of looking at the truth at all these levels and layers that the freedom continues to evolve. So, and I was thinking how this morning, how authentic you presented where your thoughts and expressions and experiences are, and I think cut out of your own personal work, I know you really met me where I am, and it's obvious you've been the personal work because of how you share what you share and the insights and that, but I want to continue that process myself. And I think the wildness of God and my own wildness is within a level of integrity that I think wouldn't misrepresent God and myself or our culture.
Yeah,
hope. So I don't think that's where you are, but that's kind of
where that's where I sure want to be. I encourage you to all read the Seabiscuit. Or go see the movie. The passage I read this morning, you know, where he's not well and he's not free. He is just a, like I say, he's a train wreck. To watch what happens in the pages following the section I read, as he connects with that trainer who studied him and knew him and learned him, and the rampaging stops, and the power and speed and through intentional wildness, freedom begins to just build on this creature. Stunning. That's my new favorite metaphor. I don't want to be rampaging. Hurts people, bruises me. I want to be wild and free, very anchored at the same time. Anchored, not angered. Anchored at the same time. Any other thoughts on this? You're right. Sometimes we are, as gay and lesbian people, we're a little bit stunted developmentally. We miss some things. When all of our buddies were dating when we were 15, and we just wanted to be with our buddies. Right? We missed a few things. I have a friend who's a Roman Catholic priest for 20 years, and he decided he wanted to be married, and his parents were heartbroken when he went and told them that he didn't want to be a priest anymore. But he and then I had a client who was an Olympic athlete who had spent her whole adolescence in the pool. You know, so she didn't want to date either. So that's the closest I've found in heterosexual experience. To see that they had to move through some developmental segments that their peers had not, couldn't understand. They had, at 35 or 40 years of age, they had to learn how to date, right, and how to be sexual, and how to, you know, move through the layers of becoming close to somebody. They had to learn that. And you and I, especially you lesbians, I don't know, you guys, you're a little more tuned in on this issue. I have never met a gay man at age 40 who says, you know, it's just occurring to me that there's a chance I could be gay. I hear that from women a fair amount. I don't hear it from men, gay men. Most of you guys knew at a fairly young age and then just went through all the mental, emotional gymnastics.
What do you think that is?
I think it's cultural.
It could be cultural, it could be more physical.
I didn't figure it out until I was 56, and I absolutely did not know.
You didn't have a clue.
I considered myself a straight man with bisexual tendencies because I was married, and I simply didn't identify with 95% of what I saw was gay culture. I couldn't stand drag. I wasn't into bars. The whole scene wasn't my scene. It wasn't me, so I couldn't be gay. I must be bisexual. And I've been faithful to my wife. I've never been with a man, so I didn't know.
You had some hunches about...
I knew I was bisexual.
Bisexual stuff.
I knew there was an interest in men, but I had been faithful in marriage for 33 years, and it wasn't until my wife chose to separate from me that I was out of the marriage for 2 or 3 years that I had a chance to figure it out, and it was a real eye-opener. It was a quick transition. But also, I was an ordained minister, so I had the entire church robe. It was a pressure lid put on, and I dared not look or go in that area at all.
Yeah. It's a great example of a life where a ton of your energy went into
absolutely
doing what you believe is the right thing.
I threw my life into my work. I ran a network of 130 colleges and universities, throughout over 39 countries. So I spent my life in my work. And somebody said to me about a year ago, it's amazing all that you've done with your life.
Yeah.
my answer was, it's amazing how much energy a lost soul can create.
Well, thank you for all that you did.
I'm not sure what his worth was at this point.
There was worth there. I want you to be careful about minimizing it.
Could you comment on the transition between an ending and a beginning? Yeah, I was sharing in a small group. I was sharing in a small group that God revealed to me last year that I lingered way too long at the edge of an ending rather than stepping over into a new beginning.
Uh-huh.
Can you speak on that?
Oh, I'd love to. There's this place between the ending and the beginning that Americans don't tend to know quite much about. It's called the neutral zone. Mm. You know, and Americans, we think, well, let's get on with it. Okay, we're retiring one business card, let's get going with the new one. You know, why do you hang out in that in-between time? I remember in 93, I had the luxury of a neutral zone. I had about 4 or 5 months where I could just be quiet and step back and look at my life, and I could do my endings very intentionally. I said goodbye very intentionally to Campus Crusade. And then I didn't leap in anything new. And it was during that time that I learned to, you know, plunge into the darkness like I talked about this morning, and to live with the tension of not knowing where I was going. And it was one of the richest periods of my life. Oh my Lord, it was so rich. To not have but God as my my constant. It's an amazing time. I really can't tell you too much about it.
Well, I wanted to say, now that you brought it up, I understand the neutral zone, but for those of us that feel a need to keep flying for fear we'll crash and burn, the neutral zone can be a very tough spot.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, it takes spiritual discipline to sit in the neutral zone and to not hop into something new too quickly. And it's very true with relationships. When you've had your heart broken, there's nothing better than to find somebody new that just thinks you're gorgeous and wants to be with you. Isn't that lovely? And sadly, those relationships still tend to continue on. And when that one's over, then you're still faced with yourself. So there's something pretty extraordinary about being able to live in the neutral zone. I had this wonderful client who was going through a divorce, and she said, you know, I went online, I found somebody I need. But she said, and she was a carpenter, she said, I'm so tempted to start going out, but I know it would be emotional spackle.
Isn't
that a great image for you? People put spackle on a wall, it looks like a wall, but all it takes is... Just gonna say emotional spackle. It would be fun. It wouldn't be the real thing. But I gotta take care of my heart and feel my heart. Yeah.
I was thinking neutral zone would just be like a debriefing time.
Sure.
One of the most difficult things in our culture is to stop.
Yeah.
And it's very culturally ingrained in us to not stop. And so in order to get that space, sometimes we have to literally leave that space in order to make that space for ourselves. And you have to break that that habit or break that anticipation that you're going to always be there. And that's true in relationships or your job or your church or your home group or whatever the case may be. And if you need space, and we all do from time to time, you have to make that space for yourself. And sometimes that's just getting away for 6 hours totally by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's getting away for 6 weeks or 6 months, 6 minutes. You know, it doesn't really matter how long that time is, but it's that stand that you take that says, this time is for me. And making yourself heard and making yourself clear are not the same thing. You really have to separate yourself from it.
And I did list a couple of allies.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You
right.
know, not necessarily friends, but you know the difference between a friend and an ally? Sometimes your best ally in creating a change like this isn't necessarily your closest friend. It's somebody that understands what Pat was just saying. And you go to them and you say, I need your help. I am just sort of in a rut here in this church. I'm not enjoying the kind of comfort and freedom that I want to have so that I can even be more, that more of me can be here. So we have coffee once a week so I can tell you how it's going. Yeah.
You know, I was in the ministry for a number of years, and one of the things I learned was really important is that God can take care of the church.
Yeah.
And sometimes when we get so involved in doing the things in church, we kind of get this feeling that, well, if I'm out there to do it, I'm going to do it. And so there's this dichotomy that happens where one side's saying, I need to get away from it, and there's other part of you that says, but they need me because I've done this and I've done that and I know how to do it. Rest assured, you can step away because God will provide all the things you're doing. He will provide. He can use other people. It might even be good for them. Maybe there's somebody there that needs to do the things you're doing. And by you stepping back, you're getting the space you need, and you're giving the opportunity for God to allow another person to serve in a way that they wish to do, but couldn't because you're doing.
Thank you. That's very true. I need to hear that.
And if there's a part of you that's a little scared that if you don't stay busy doing, you'll be all by yourself.
Yeah.
I know that sometimes can be a little bit scary. Somebody over here. Yeah.
You know, I've heard a theme running all through our conversation today, and I thought of it earlier when we were talking about this falling business, and I do think there's a danger in using cliches and applying cliches like falling when it may not be falling at all, you know. But the one thing I've heard coming up in a lot of different ways, and I think you implied it this morning also, Patricia, and that is we have absolutely no power over what happens to us. We don't. We have no power over what comes to us. But we have, our power comes in how we choose to respond.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning we make.
Yeah, the decisions we make. And I just wanted to say that because I've heard that coming, I've heard that same thing coming up so many ways, things happening to us. And we can't do anything about that. But we do have power over how we choose to respond. That's where our power comes from.
Well, we have about 3 minutes left. Anybody that you have a question in the back of your mind and you haven't raised your hand yet, you want us to hear you put voice to? Or...
I got to say something, but I do have a question. You opened up the session by asking what we thought, how we felt about that space, that spaciousness.
Yeah.
And could you elaborate on that, just to kind of bring us back? Because there is an element where the church says it's this narrow little way, follow the narrow path. And I got the sense that maybe that spaciousness has to do with that path that we walk, and that we're taught to walk.
Yeah.
Narrowly.
You know, there are a lot of things in the Sermon on the Mount that are a bit paradoxical. There's something very Old Covenant about the Sermon on the Mount. And when I think about Matthew 7, about the way is narrow, I think that that's in reference to the cross in some way. To the, like I said this morning, the mystery of what happened to the cross. There's something extraordinary about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ that is narrow and unique and freeing at the same time. The spaciousness I'm talking about is what I think is the norm. When a life is anchored in a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, there should be great power and elbow room and influence for good. So that's what I think of the spaciousness is the description of our behavior as believers. that it's not as though we're not going to bump into people. But I think the norm is for us to be people of extraordinary power and freedom.
I was just going to ask you, so the spaciousness is that element in our life once you step through that narrow way.
It's like
the eye of the needle and the camel issue.
Yeah, I think so.
Like a door in a house. The door is going to be narrow. Mm-hmm. Once you get in the house, it's big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the narrow way that's difficult is not how we walk every step of our life. Once we've accepted Christ and moved into that room, it's making that initial step of acceptance and faithful.
To me, it's a bit like if God were to say to you, build me a house. You could take a number of runs at it. You could say, well, sure, God, if you just give me the blueprints and the courses in wiring and plumbing and carpentry, then sure, I'll build your house to specifications. And that's how a lot of people live the Christian life, right? When I speak of spaciousness, it is more like God saying, build me a house. You know, of the billions of people on the planet, you are unique in your talents and abilities and in the way you build a house. So please just get to know me, delight in me, and build me a house that would be an expression of who you are and what you think God would like. And do whatever you need to do to prepare yourself. And then go. And just the freedom and spaciousness of that kind of creativity. I think that's what it means for us to author our lives. Yes, in closing.
I just had a quick reflection on freedom. As you're talking about, I think with freedom comes responsibility. And that's something that that some of us are going through struggles now, some have been through them, and we're all going to continue to have struggles. The road, although it's narrow, it's still a road, and it still exists, and God takes ordinary people and helps them do extraordinary things. So when we fix all the things that are wrong in our lives, we'll be able to be better ministers, because there's thousands of gay, lesbian, youth, and young adults, and adults our age and above, that whether they don't go to church at all, or they're in a church life and they're being oppressed, they need the kind of direction that groups like these set for them.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a long time thing in coming, and we have responsibilities out there. The only way we'll be able to fulfill these responsibilities is if we're in touch with our own selves and feel good about ourselves to go to step two. The freedom is great, but it comes with responsibility.
Yeah, I think that will be the hallmark of the coming decade. You know, our freedom and our responsibility. We'll have more and more people looking at us, watching us, and hoping to be able to respect our lives. I think the majority of the American public is giving us the benefit of the doubt.
Sure, and now that the stop me laws have been struck down, but now there's another backlash, according to USA Today. Because of that, the general public is, and the Christian right is on the move again. So just think, once you cross one hurdle, another hurdle comes up. And that's,
okay, remember, we're not going to be reactive. We're not going to escalate with them. We're going to keep breathing. We're going to consider our lives.
That was good.
Here's a very much.